1, 2, 3, 4.
So, what are the characteristics of a radical learning space? To start with, a self-directed approach to curriculum.
Brenda, student, med school, Providence, Rhode Island.
Like, whatever you want to do, you can do as long as you want to do it.
Often this approach necessitates a small school. DJ, student, med school.
You know, and there's enough staff for each kid that, you know, build relationships. I know this staff person well, I know the other staff person well. And you know, you build a relationship, they understand who you are and you understand who they are. You know, it helps a lot better when there's not 500 kids and there's only, you know, 12 staff members or whatever.
We looked at public and private schools, especially seeking those with work trade, sliding scale, or no tuition. Catherine, volunteer, Brooklyn Free School.
The school is a sliding scale, so you come here if you want to come here. It doesn't matter what your educational background has been. It doesn't matter what your parents' income. If you want to be here, if you understand the school, if your parents want, you know, understand it, then you're here, no matter what you pay.
This effort to create space for people of all income backgrounds speaks to another of our criteria, a commitment to creating social change. We also looked for spaces that were not based on any specific model, and instead formed through direct community input and geographical setting. We were interested in places where students learn from experiences beyond the walls of their building. When learning is based locally, students have a context for what they are learning, and are learning things that are relevant to them.
Taranda, student, Making Changes Freedom School, San Pablo, California.
You know about everything in the textbook, but you don't know about your own culture. She said, that's sad. She said, I'm going to teach, and then she teaches us about it, because she says it's important to know about your culture.
Meg, intern, med school.
That act of asking the kids about what's important to them and what's relevant to them is, like, awesome. You know, when one of the kids is reading No More Prisons and, like, one of the kids is analyzing stats about, like, crime and probation and money and socioeconomic status and race and immigration status for her neighborhood, you know, and, like, that's culturally relevant to them individually.
Another criteria was that people of all ages are respected and valued equally. And that students aren't categorized into grade levels based on their age alone, so they can learn from each other's interests and skills.
A lot of radical learning spaces have no letter grades and non-competitive atmospheres.
Andy, founder, Puget Sound Community School, Seattle, Washington.
I mean, you know whether you've done something well or not. You don't need me to tell you. I mean, you just kind of have a hunch and knowledge. What I can give you is maybe a certain level of expertise that maybe you don't quite have because you haven't had the experience that I have. And so what I would ask students is, do you want my perspective? I want to carry to kids that they really know more about themselves than I ever will. So how do you get them to know that they're their own expert?
We looked for places that make decisions collectively and everyone can participate.
Melanie, founder, The New School, Newark, Delaware.
We don't treat a 6-year-old any differently than we do a 16-year-old. Some schools will try to restrict the little guys, but no, everyone here has the same rights and obligations, whether you're, you know, 60 or 16 or 6 years old.
Scott, teacher, Village Free School, Portland, Oregon.
I think that people are surprised sometimes by their power. At all levels. I think there was a time where the students in all school meeting voted for something where all the staff voted against it and the students all voted for it.
When people govern themselves together, structures and rules are more relevant. Melanie.
You see kids walking around and kids are, you know, on computers and they're talking and they're sitting on sofas or whatever they're doing. You think, well, there's no structure. There's nothing happening here. It's actually a very structured school. There are just not arbitrary structures.
Everyone chooses where money goes. David, student, The New School.
Like, let's just say that you have $20 and there's a big boom box that costs $40. So if you add school meeting just to have $20 more dollars, then you can be able to buy the boom box, but you have to bring it here and for people to, play around with it.
To operate collectively, students need to be able to effectively communicate and resolve conflicts. Callie, student, Paulo Freire Freedom School, Tucson, Arizona.
Usually at my old school, people would like go to the principal or something, or like get detention or whatever. But at this school, we have something called like an RJC, which is a Restorative Justice Council. There's like a committee of kids that help other kids instead of adults making really strict punishments. It helps you learn from your mistakes more than just get in trouble for it.
Students learn responsibility from experience, not from fear of being sent to the principal's office. Bowen, teacher, Albany Free School, Albany, New York.
It's freedom, not license. Like, we don't give kids a license to do whatever they want. They have the freedom to sort of be who they are and pursue what they want to pursue, with the understanding that there's a responsibility to the community as well. Like, you can't just do whatever you want if what you're doing is, like, disrupting, you know, another group of kids or other things. Free school doesn't mean free from all. I mean, there's a lot of responsibility that comes with it, you know.
Teachers follow young people's lead rather than imparting a certain type of knowledge in a certain way. Krista, teacher, Oak Grove School, Ojai, California.
Best part of teaching young children is they're so excited to learn, and it's contagious, and it keeps all of us motivated to come every day because they are just so, you know, a ladybug on a leaf can just be the entire day's, you know, curriculum because they're so interested in every little, especially living things in the natural world.
We wanted to explore spaces where people recognize that learning happens by doing and experiencing, that learning and living don't have to be separate entities, and that learning doesn't stop when you graduate. Of course, not every place we visited matched up with all of these points, but these are the commonalities, the strands and threads we identified in knitting together the big picture of radical learning spaces today. Dennis, founder of the Met School, expresses his frustration with these values being called alternative.
It's like alternative medicine. The alternative medicine is the natural, real medicine that cures us. It's the other stuff that they make up in a lab.
A school like this might sound like a dream, but the 23 spots we visited are just a handful of countless real-life radical learning spaces. And these schools draw from an amazing history of radical learning and social change movements.
Is it okay that I don't know the words?
Yeah.
Before our current culture, a higher value was placed on the wisdom and learning that comes from families and neighbors through the course of a lifetime. Natasha, unschooler, Oakland.
We can look at different cultures all around the world that, the way the youth learn is much more organic. It's just they see their adults, their mother, their father, their aunts, uncles, friends, doing what they do, and they learn by observing and by participating. And that's how they learn their role and seek out what they're interested in.
Though this type of learning is kept alive in some places, Western civilization over the past several hundred years has wiped out a lot of it. But it hasn't wiped out everything.
In 1930s Spain, a group of women came together to empower Spanish women and free themselves from the enslavements of ignorance, industry, and sexism. They called themselves Mujeres Libres. They set up learning spaces for basic adult literacy and professional skills, young farm-working women, refugees, and children. The ideas we spoke of earlier in describing radical learning spaces mirror the central principles of learning set up by the Mujeres Libres. About 30 years later, on the other side of the Atlantic, African American people created an education liberation movement in Mississippi called Freedom Summer. Activists in the civil rights movement set up 41 schools in the summer of 1964 that taught regional history, Black history, core academic subjects, and tools and skills for creating change in schools and in society. The project culminated with a student-led conference in Meridian, Mississippi, where young Black people prepared a statement of their needs and networked and discussed together. Meanwhile, in Brazil, an educator named Paulo Freire became famous for using a learning practice he called popular education to teach a group of 300 sugarcane workers how to read and write in 45 days. Freire believed that people learn best through their own experiences, and that by connecting these individual experiences to larger societal problems, people can raise their own consciousness and empower themselves to affect change. He believed that every person is both teacher and student, and called his classes cultural circles. After the success of the sugarcane workers, the Brazilian government created 1,000 cultural circles in many areas of Brazil. A little later, the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California, started an elementary school with a similar goal: to create an education system that was relevant to the experience of African American children growing up in a racist society. In 1974, the Oakland Community School graduated its first class, and it served the community, educating hundreds of students for 8 years under the direction of community activist Erica Huggins. Though these projects were very significant and influential, they remain fairly obscure in the eyes of the general public and in the retelling of radical education history. Perhaps this is because they were by and for oppressed people. Usually, much more focus in education history is placed on learning centers started and populated by people with privilege who do not experience oppression as a group. Earlier in the century, near Dresden, Germany, A.S. Neal founded Summerhill School, based on the principles of student-directed learning. Students at Summerhill were free of coercion and planned how their time was spent and how the school was run. In the United States in the late 1960s, a resurgence of inspiration based on Summerhill spawned two schools that are still operating today. Daniel Greenberg and Mimsy Sadowski opened the Sudbury Valley School in Framingham, Massachusetts in 1968 with a focus on the freedom of the individual student to find and follow their passions. The following year, Mary Loya opened Albany Free School in Albany, New York with a similar set of principles, but in an urban setting and with more focus on community and social justice. These are the schools most commonly cited as influences for the learning spaces we visited on our trip. These examples from history can put our current education system in a whole new light. How do kids view their learning today? What lessons do schools teach to prepare students for the world?